Alright, I believe we're now entering the story of Joseph again at chapter 40 of Genesis. And Joseph has demonstrated his integrity in the house of Potiphar where he was a slave. Not only his integrity in terms of financial management and his competence too, but also his integrity, his refusal to succumb to the seduction of Potiphar's wife. And this angered her, and she falsely accused him, so he was put into prison. And as I said, the reason he was put into prison is because Potiphar could not possibly have believed her story. And he had to be put in prison because he couldn't ignore his wife's charges. That would be a supreme insult to her. On the other hand, he didn't believe them either, or else he would have killed Joseph. Any slave that would attack his master's wife would certainly be summarily dispatched with the sword. And Joseph was not only spared the sword and put in prison, but he's actually put into a prison where he had the chance of advancement. Not that the highest position of a prisoner in those days would really necessarily be a very comfortable position, but at least he was not treated as if he was really a criminal. I mean, he was, in that he was in prison, but he was treated as if he might be a trustworthy fellow and one whom the head of the prison could even put in charge of things. And that's what we find. And the end of chapter 39, the Lord was with Joseph. This is while he's in prison. In verse 21 of chapter 39, and showed mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison, just as he had given him favor with Potiphar. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. So he must have arranged their work duties and their meal times and their everything they were doing. He was given the charge over it, though he was a prisoner himself. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because Yahweh was with him, and whatever he did, Yahweh made to prosper. Now, chapter 40, it came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt, and Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them so that they were in the custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with his own interpretation. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said, "We each have a dream. We have each dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph, and he said to him, "Behold, in my dream a vine was before a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention to me of Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I've done nothing here that they should put me into this dungeon." Now when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, "I also was in my dream, and there I had three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket there were all kinds of baked goods, for Pharaoh. And the birds ate them out of the basket on my head. So Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head. Actually, it should be lift up your head. The New King James changed it to sort of give the sense of it. But it's the same phrase that we used in verse 13. He will lift up your head, but it has a different meaning here. He will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. Now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. However, this didn't, you know, it was not a wasted episode, because we know that the butler eventually remembered him again, and that changed everything. And so we can see that these two men ended up in that prison by the providence of God. Joseph could easily have been just forgotten there forever and never have been brought to the attention of Pharaoh. But in order that he would be eventually brought to the attention of Pharaoh, God ordained it that these two men would be arrested and put in prison and would be put under Joseph's charge and would have dreams while they were there, and that Joseph would be able to commend himself to them by interpreting their dreams, and that would prepare for the butler to realize when Pharaoh had a dream that Joseph could interpret it. I mean, all of this was a setup from God, as we know, because it was God's prophecy to Joseph earlier in his life that his brothers would bow down to him. God knew how that was going to happen. It was going to happen through Joseph being elevated in Egypt at a time of famine when his brothers would have to come and do obeisance to him. And so God knew all of this at the very beginning of Joseph's career, before he was ever sold into slavery. God knew that Joseph was going to be raised up into Pharaoh's house. But you know what? He probably could never have gotten raised up there from Potiphar's house. He might have, of course, if he had interpreted some dream for Potiphar, and Potiphar was in a position to hear that Pharaoh had a dream that he wanted to interpret, maybe something would have happened. But the butler was much more in a position to hear Pharaoh's concerns about the dream, because he was with Pharaoh every day. Potiphar probably was not. Potiphar might never have learned of Pharaoh's dream. So in a sense, Joseph's step down into prison was the first step back up. He was eventually going to go higher than any other person in Egypt other than Pharaoh himself. He was going to be exalted that high, but he couldn't get there from Potiphar's house. He had to get there from prison, because there he would meet the butler. And it's the butler who did it, as in all mysteries. The butler actually hadn't done anything wrong in this case. He was innocent. It was the baker who had done it. Done what? Well, according to Jewish tradition, and I think it's a fair inference that they have got it right, these two men were arrested because Pharaoh's birthday was coming up. We know that because his birthday was 3 days after this, and it specifically mentions it was his birthday. It doesn't have to mention that, but it was Pharaoh's birthday coming up. And apparently, in the preparations for the special meals and so forth that were going to be assigned for that birthday party, the butler and the baker had both come under suspicion for some reason. Perhaps some cache of some poisonous thing was found in the kitchen, and it was clear there was some plot to do the Pharaoh in at his birthday. And therefore, it was not known whether the butler or the baker was guilty, and so they're both put in prison until it could be investigated. The baker was found to be the guilty party, and so he's hanged. The butler was found innocent, so he's restored to his post. The butler was the wine taster for Pharaoh. Kings usually, there were always people who wanted to kill kings. Even their sons and other people wanted to take their thrones from them. So poisoning was something they always had to guard against. And therefore, they usually would not just drink the wine that's brought directly from the kitchen. They would have the butler, actually, the wine taster, taste the wine in their presence. And if he didn't gag and fall over and die, then it was considered safe for the Pharaoh to drink it. That's what Nehemiah did in the court of Artaxerxes in Persia. Nehemiah was the cupbearer for the king. And this man was the cupbearer, the butler for the king, and so he was the wine taster. It might be obvious that the wine taster would not wish to poison Pharaoh, at least not through the wine, since it would mean his own life as well, since he had to taste it. But it wasn't clear. I'm reading between the lines here. This is basically the way the rabbis have figured out the story behind the story. But it makes sense. It makes sense of everything. That both these men were under suspicion. They're both kitchen help. Not kitchen help. They're both in charge. One's in charge of the wine. One's in charge of the bread. And, one of them had apparently been involved in a plot to do Pharaoh in, and since they're both involved with food services, probably it was a poison issue. But they were put in prison while the matter could be searched out. In that time, in the providence of God, they each dreamed a dream. And Joseph comes to them in the morning and says, "Why are you so sad today?" Isn't that funny? They're in a dungeon. He says, "Why are you sad? What are you supposed to be when you're in a dungeon?" Joseph must have been, kind of unusually cheerful for a prisoner in a third world prison. But he says, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said, "What do you think?" No, they didn't say, "What do you think?" They said, "We've had dreams, and we can't interpret these dreams." Now, Joseph had, as far as we know, Joseph had no experience in interpreting dreams, although his brothers and his dad had interpreted his dreams and had not liked the interpretations. So he had he was familiar with the idea that a dream might mean something, might have an interpretation. But Joseph said, "Well, the interpretation of dreams, that's God's province. God can do that. So tell me what they are." It's interesting how those two things. He says, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me." By implication, I'm in touch with God. If God wants you to know the interpretation, he can tell me what it is. And sure enough, he did. Now, the dreams had features in them that are related to what these men did for a living. The baker and the butler each had dreams related to their tasks. The butler spoke first, and he had seen three branches on a vine. Vines are, of course, where wine comes from. And so he gathered clusters, he crushed them in the cup, and he gave it to Pharaoh again. So we see that, he's back at his post. The only thing really hard to interpret about this is that the three branches represent 3 days. And by the way, that's the most impressive feature of it. Because anyone might have guessed it's a 50-50 chance this guy will be restored. But to give the time frame for the fulfillment is unusual, even for prophets in the Old Testament. They very seldom give the actual time frame of when this is going to happen. But Joseph knew from the three branches that represented 3 days, and that was going to be the time of fulfillment. And, of course, after he gives that, and he realizes that this butler is going to be back in the presence of Pharaoh, he realizes that he, Joseph, is now going to have a friend in court. A butler is not exactly the kind of servant of the Pharaoh who really can persuade Pharaoh to do what he wants to do. That is to say, he's not somebody that the Pharaoh listens to for strategic counsel about what to do about his prisoners and things like that. But nonetheless, he was the best shot that Joseph had. The only guy he knew that he had really had conversation with, who might be indebted to him for this interpretation, and who Joseph knew was going to be regularly in the presence of Pharaoh. So he made his appeal and said, "Listen, when you're back with Pharaoh, please tell him about me. I haven't done anything to be put in prison. I'm innocent, and I don't even belong in this country. I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. If I could just go home, that'd be really nice." So it's a long shot. But, Joseph, who did have some prophetic insight, might well have seen just in the circumstance the providence of God, and, hey, this may be my ticket. This guy, he's going back to Pharaoh. Who could let me out of prison other than Pharaoh? And so he makes his request at it. Of course, it's 2 years after this before anything comes of it, so Joseph's faith is tested even 2 more years. By the way, a year in a third world jail is probably difficult. 2 years, twice as difficult. But the baker then saw that the interpretation was a good one, and he thought, "Well, maybe I'll get a good interpretation too." So he He told his dream. There were three baskets of bread on his head, which were no doubt for Pharaoh. And the birds of the air came and ate the bread off his head. In other words, it was unprotected. He's responsible for this bread. He shouldn't be letting the birds get at it. It's the royal bread. There's obviously some negligence on his part here. And therefore, it's a negative scene. The butler squeezing grapes into a glass and giving it to Pharaoh, that's a positive thing. That's his regular job. That's what he wants to do. The baker, however, is kind of falling down on his duty here and letting the birds get at the royal bread. And Joseph said, well, those baskets are 3 days and those birds are going to be picking at your flesh. And we find it fell out exactly the way Joseph said it would. And so the baker is hanged and the butler is restored, but immediately forgot about Joseph. Now chapter 41. Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine looking and fat. And they fed in the meadow. And behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine looking and fat cows. So Pharaoh awoke. That would be disturbing. I mean, cows don't eat each other. Cows don't eat meat. And in this, he's got these scary looking gaunt skeletal cows come out and they're like carnivores and they eat up these fat cows. Weird dream. He wakes up disturbed but managed to get back to sleep, only to be disturbed by another dream. He slept and dreamed a second time. And suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on 1 stalk, plump and good. And behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream. Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. Remember I said when we were talking about dreams before that certainly not all dreams are prophetic, not all dreams are from God, not all dreams have a message. But on the occasions in the Bible when people do have dreams that are from God, it seems like they know it. When they wake up, their spirit is disturbed. I mentioned that there's been a very few times that I've had dreams that have turned out to be truly from God. And in each of those cases, I woke up really disturbed and really affected and really aware that there was something more than ordinarily true about those dreams. And so we see Pharaoh that way too. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had a similar experience in Daniel chapter 2. He had dreamed something but he either forgot what the dream was or pretended to forget. And he asked his wise men to tell him not only the interpretation, but to tell him what the dream itself was with no clues. And they were unable to do that. I'm surprised, however, that Pharaoh's wise men here couldn't interpret the dream once told to them. At least give some kind of interpretation, whether it was fake or otherwise. I mean, these guys, this is what they did for a living. You can almost get it right just guessing. It's about cows and grain, food, right? And there's fat ones, and then they're consumed by skinny ones. I mean, an imaginative wise man of the Pharaoh might have easily picked up on this. You know, there's the fat cows, fat grain, that speaks of abundant food. Skinny cows, blighted grain, that seems to speak of famine. Now, what might not be possible for them to get is the number of years. And again, this is where Joseph was able to shine, because he, again, in terms of these dreams, what he came up with that others maybe couldn't is that these 7 ears and these 7 cows, that represents 7 years, and therefore a time element is revealed. But it would seem that these wise men, if they did this kind of thing for a living, I mean, I'm sure they were fakes. I'm sure they didn't really have any revelation from God about these things, but they had learned to be good fakes. They were able to convince the Pharaoh most of the time that they knew what it was about. And so it wouldn't take an awful lot of imagination for them to come up with something here, but maybe even God himself just blinded them so that Joseph would get his stab at it. And they could not interpret them to Pharaoh. Verse 9, then the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants, and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker. We each dreamed a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now, there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him. And he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man, he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. It's interesting that when he's telling this story, he mentions that Joseph was a Hebrew man, a servant of the captain of the guard. He doesn't actually mention he's a prisoner, a political prisoner, a criminal, as a convicted criminal. Instead, he refers to him as a servant of the jailkeeper. So he doesn't bring up the fact that Joseph is there on the status of a criminal, but rather leaves it open that he might just be an employee of the prison. Anyway, then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. This bit of shaving is just a little bit of authenticity here. Of course, Joseph had not been shaving in prison. For one thing, Hebrews don't shave even when they're out of prison. It's the Hebrew custom to wear beards, but not the Egyptian custom. The Egyptians shaved their heads and their beards. And so this is mentioned just in passing. It could have been left out, but it's obviously an authentic bit of the preparation he'd have to go to come before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream and interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh the answer of peace. Now, again, Joseph is making sure that he gives God the credit. And he could have given the interpretation without verbalizing that. I mean, in his own heart, he could have said, well, God, I'm counting on you to give me the interpretation. But he made sure that Pharaoh knew that it's not himself. In that sense, he almost removes himself one step from any credit for this, which means removing himself one step from any gratitude Pharaoh might have to him. I mean, he's basically saying, if you get what you want, you should thank God for that, not me. And yet, Joseph's freedom is going to depend on Pharaoh having gratitude toward Joseph himself. But Joseph's not looking out for his own interests, really, here. He's making sure that God gets the credit for it. And he said, it's not me. God will give Pharaoh the answer of peace. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river, that'd be the Nile. Suddenly seven cows came up out of the river, fine looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then behold, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I've never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows. When they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they'd eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. So I awoke. Also I saw in my dream, and suddenly seven heads came up on one stalk, full and good. And behold, seven heads, withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians. But there was no one who could explain it to me. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one, and God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. There's just one meaning for both of them. He said, and the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after him are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God. Now, God had not yet stated this principle, but in Deuteronomy, twice it says, in the mouth of two or more witnesses, every word will be established. And actually that verse in Deuteronomy is quoted or alluded to 5 times in the New Testament. It's apparently a very important principle. Something is not to be considered established as true unless there's at least more than one witness of it. And so Joseph apparently knew that principle before it was ever given in the law. He said, God gave you 2 witnesses about this so that you know it's established by God, because it's certain. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Notice, I wonder how much Joseph at this point was beginning to, press his options here. Find a discerning and wise man, like these Egyptian magicians. Well, no, they couldn't interpret your dream. I guess they're not that wise. Maybe you can find someone wise enough, though. You know, there could be a wise and discerning man somewhere in the land. Find someone like that and send him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in their cities. Then the food shall be as reserved for the land in the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land, and Egypt, land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. Now, actually, we don't know, no one knows the exact time of these events. Their approximate time, well, I should say, their time can be, the years this happened can be figured out from the chronology of the Bible, but no one knows exactly who the Pharaoh was at this time. There's more than one possibility. And as far as establishing that there was a 7-year famine after 7 years of plenty at that particular time from any secular records, it's asking too much for us to try to have that kind of information detailed for us in the secular records. But we do know from archaeology that Egypt was subject to seasons of famine as well as seasons of plenty. Usually, though, seasons of famine were not as severe in Egypt as in other places. And that's why Abraham went down to Egypt during the time of a famine. And Isaac considered it, but God told him not to go down there. But people typically went to Egypt at times of famine because even though the rain didn't exist, the Nile still had water in it. And they could irrigate and therefore grow crops during that time. But when a famine would even come to Egypt, it was really a severe situation. And there have been some. And there have been storage cities uncovered from earlier strata of Egypt's history, where they actually had cities with just huge storage buildings for grain and stuff like that. And those might have been built at Joseph's recommendation, because he said they should store up the grain in the cities. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this man, in whom is the Spirit of God?" Now, it says Spirit of God in the New King James. The word God is Elohim, and therefore some translations would translate Spirit of the Gods. And, of course, it's entirely possible that that's what Pharaoh said. The Egyptians were generally polytheistic, and so he might not have been speaking about the true God here so much as just the Spirit of the Gods is with this man. Now, there was one pharaoh who was notably monotheistic, Akhenaten, but it's not generally believed that he was the pharaoh at this time, so this was probably a polytheistic pharaoh and would have said this man has the spirit of the gods in him, of the Elohim. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as Elohim has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, which simply meant that Joseph would now be able to transact official business in the name of Pharaoh, because he'd have his signet. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. What a sudden reversal that is. He has spent, at this point, 13 years in Egypt as a servant of Potiphar and as a prisoner. We don't know how long he was in Potiphar's house before he was a prisoner, but between those two venues, he had been 13 years because he was 17 years old when he was sold into slavery. And we will find that he was 30 years old on this occasion when he came out of the prison. So there were 13 years of waiting for God when he had the dreams from God that his brothers would someday bow to him. Obviously, he had dreams that he would be in a position of authority at some time. And yet, as a slave, with no option of being bought out of slavery, and then worse, as a prisoner, thrown away for life, imprisonment, and they threw away the key, and, you know, he's out of sight, certainly out of mind. How could there ever be any fulfillment of those dreams that God had given him? Now, we are not told whether Joseph during those years lost faith or not. I mean, he didn't lose his faith in God. Whether he began to question whether those dreams that he'd had were from God, I don't know. But it seems like he's fairly confident in spite of all those things. This man was a man of unusual faith, it would appear, because, well, I mean, his faith may have been renewed when the butler and the baker had their dreams. You know, maybe that he had lost confidence until then, but then he saw, this is God's provision here. This is my ticket out of here. If he did, he was right. And he probably did sort of see that possibility at least. But it's an amazing thing how, you know, it'd be amazing enough if a slave became the grand vizier of Egypt, which is what he became, second in command under the Pharaoh. It's like a prime minister. But he wasn't a slave, he was a prisoner, a political prisoner. And he's elevated from that dungeon into the place of the second chariot, where people are commanded with runners ahead of him as he goes down the street telling people to bow the knee to him. That's just an amazing turnaround. So, Pharaoh also said to Joseph, 44, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Just a figure of speech. Nobody can do anything of significance without Joseph's permission. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah. And there's been many suggestions as to what it means. The most popular suggestion, say, is that it means God speaks and he lives. But some think it means something like interpreter of dreams or something like that, too. The Egyptian, ancient Egyptian, is not that well known yet. Ancient Egyptian really was not understood by Western people at all until the finding of the Rosetta Stone by Napoleon, actually, in Egypt. But that was still in very modern history. And then it took a long time for them to learn how to decipher the hieroglyphic. But, of course, scholars are learning a lot more about the language all the time. But they're still not, they're not really certain. There's not full agreement as to what Zaphnath-Paneah means. And Pharaoh gave Joseph a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. So he married the daughter of a clergyman in the pagan temple. But we don't read anything about her being a problem to him in that respect. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. He laid it up in every city, the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain, as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was without number. So this passes over the 7 years of plenty with just the summary statement that he gathered up. We know he gathered up 20% of the national product to store up. Now, it's probable that the Egyptians were already giving something like 10% for the maintenance of Pharaoh and his government. That was a fairly typical taxation in those days to support the king and his administration. So I don't know if they just added another 10% on in order to put that aside for the famine, or if they added 20% more onto the 10. But they, it was pretty steep taxation. Not as steep as what we pay, but still pretty steep. In America, I think middle class people probably pay, what, about 40% or something like that? It's close to it. So even now, the Egyptians, with these extreme measures of taxation, still were probably not as heavily taxed as we are becoming accustomed to be. Now it says, and to Joseph were born two sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, which means forgetting. For God has made me to forget all my toil and all of my father's house. In other words, I used to long to go home to my father's house, but that's kind of slipped my mind lately. It's kind of better here. I like it here better than my father's house. Certainly in his position of power, he could, if he had wished, have sent a servant back to his father to say, Dad, I'm okay. Come on over and see me. But he didn't do that. He could have even no doubt gotten some vacation time and gone down to see his family himself, but he had forgotten. He hadn't forgotten in the sense that he didn't remember at all, but his longing for his father's house had pretty much disappeared. That doesn't mean he'd lost his affection for his father, but I think that Joseph spent those 7 years contemplating how he is going to engineer the restoration of himself and his family. And I believe that when his brothers finally showed up, that everything he did with them had been well thought out. I don't think he was just playing it by ear, being alternately peevish and alternately friendly and so forth, just as the mood hit him. I believe that Joseph had 7 years, and he was a smart guy. He knew his brothers were going to come and bow down to him someday, because he'd got to give him prophetic dreams about that. I think he had given a lot of thought, and who wouldn't? Anyone would. When this happens, when I see my brothers again, how am I going to react? What am I going to do for them or to them? Or what is it I want to accomplish when I finally see them? And I believe he spent those 7 years, although he'd forgotten all his father's house. That just means he'd lost his longing to go back there, which had been probably very dominant while he was in prison and a slave. But I don't think he forgot about his father, or forgot that his brothers were there, or that they were going to be coming. And I think he gave that some thought. But his son Manasseh was that name because it means forgetting. And then he had another son, a second one, and he named him Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Ephraim means twice fruitful, or double fruitful. And he had become fruitful. Then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt, there was bread, not because there wasn't famine there, but because they had stored it up. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do it. So Joseph's been in power for 7 years, and Pharaoh still has complete confidence in Joseph. And why not? Joseph has seen the coming 7 years of plenty correctly, and he's now made provision. Egypt is rich enough to support itself and the surrounding lands that would come and buy grain. He ought to be happy with Joseph. And Joseph does Pharaoh a lot more good than this as time goes by. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because of the famine that was severe in all lands. So, first of all, we read of the Egyptians coming to their king, and they are sent to Joseph, so they begin to buy back their own grain that they had been storing up over the years. They've been giving it in rather excessive taxation, and now they're buying it back from Pharaoh, so he's getting rich off them again, and then he's going to get money from other countries too, because other countries are going to need his grain as well. So he's going to become the international, breadbasket here. And the only thing that's really important about that for us, for our story, is how that affected Joseph's family, which becomes the focus of the next chapter, chapter 42. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" Almost makes it look like they, you know, they're looking at each other hungrily. Maybe. Don't look at each other that way. There's food in Egypt. Go get real food. And he said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to the place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die." So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "Lest some calamity befall him." Benjamin, by the way, would not be a little boy at this time. He'd have to be at least a teenager, possibly close to 20 years old. Joseph had been gone for 13 years. And, you know, I'm not sure how old Benjamin was at the time that Joseph was sent into slavery. But even if Benjamin had only been 5 years old at the time, or so, he'd be close to 20 at this time. But still the apple of his father's eye, the last surviving son of his deceased favorite wife. And so he's not taking any chances with Benjamin, he thinks. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Now, Joseph's an important man. Would he really be handling every little transaction of grain? You know, with thousands of people coming to buy, wouldn't he have subordinates, you know, handling the transactions? I think he probably would. When it says Joseph is the one selling it, I think it means that he's the one responsible for overseeing the operation of selling the grain to people. But he knew his brothers would be coming. I'm just going to guess that either he was providentially on the site when his brothers came up and approached one of the merchants, one of the Egyptian merchants, and Joseph recognized him and said, I'll handle this transaction. Or he may have even had his own servants on the lookout for them, knowing they were going to have to come. They're going to be here someday. They're going to be hungry. They'll be showing up. And when these men show up from Canaan, let me know about it, because I want to deal with them myself. In any case, however it happened, Joseph found himself dealing directly with his brothers. And it says, Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. Verse 6. So there's a fulfillment of his dream. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Now, it might seem strange that they wouldn't recognize their brother, though he recognized them. But he had changed much more than they had. For one thing, he was younger when they'd last seen him. He was still a teenager. Now he is close to 40 years old. He'd been 30 when he was elevated to power. Then there were 7 years of plenty. And now there's probably been close part of another year. He's probably 38 years old or so. Getting close to 40, he's more than twice the age that he was when they last saw him. Plus, he's shaved, which, Hebrews, that's uncommon. He may have had one of those little kind of rectangular little beards coming out the chin, like Egyptian officials sometimes did. But he had bare cheeks. He was speaking Egyptian, for one thing. We read this later. He was speaking through a translator, so they didn't know he spoke their language. And he could hear what they were saying and understand them, but they didn't know it because he was using a translator. And he was dressed in all this Egyptian garb. And he was the last person they expected to run into. I mean, his voice could have changed in the meantime. His language was different. He was more than twice the age they'd last seen him. They assumed Joseph was dead, so they weren't expecting this to be him. And they just didn't put it together. But, of course, they still looked about the same. They were older, but they still had the same beards and style of dress and voices and language and so forth. It wasn't hard to recognize them, but he was very different looking. And he was expecting them. They were not expecting to see him. So that has a lot to do with it, too. And so he could play with them a little bit. He spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, and they did not recognize him. Verse 9. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord." But your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are all honest men. Well, that was a bit of an exaggeration, but part of that was true. Your servants are not spies. But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And nakedness of the land is just a Hebraism that means the vulnerability. Looking for the weak spots of Egypt, like they represent some hostile government looking for the chinks in Egypt's armor. That's what he's accusing them of. And they said, your servants are 12 brothers, sons of one man in the land of Canaan. In fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more, meaning Joseph. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying you are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. And this is the point here. All that Joseph did from this point on with them was that they were being tested, as he said. They didn't understand the nature of the test. And we don't even understand until it reaches its climax. But he had this test already arranged for them. And it began this way. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall all be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you. Or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Just to let them worry a little bit. He wasn't going to keep them there. But that they went to prison for 3 days. I mean, what he had said is, you're going to stay here until your brother comes back. I'm going to send one of you guys back to get your brother. And the rest of you will rot here until he comes back. Well, they knew that their dad wouldn't send Benjamin back. So as far as they knew, that this prison was the rest of their life. But he just gave them a little scare. And then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine to your houses. So he reversed it. Instead of all of you staying in prison and one goes, we'll keep one of you in prison and the others go. And he says also, bring your youngest brother to me so your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, not knowing that he could understand them as they spoke in his presence, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Notice, this has been 20 years, and they're still carrying around such guilt about Joseph that it's the first thing that comes to their mind when something goes wrong. I mean, something's gone wrong, it's because of what we did to Joseph. You know, I mean, it is indeed. And one might expect them to think that if this happened, say, the next year or sometime after that. But 20 years have passed and it's still the prominent thing on their conscience. Joseph, we did this thing to Joseph. We ignored the agony of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we had no mercy on him. And that's why this is happening. It's like, when you've got some unresolved guilt, it doesn't really go away, even after decades. And you can tell that it's that way when first time something goes wrong, you think, God's punishing me. You know, God's punishing me for what I did back there. When that's happening, it's time for you to repent and get clean and get rid of that guilt. But they have not come clean yet. And Reuben answered them, saying, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen? Therefore, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And he himself turned away from them and wept. Then he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Now, Joseph, this is a very poignant thing for him because he's seen his brothers for the first time, and he realizes that they're still feeling guilty about what they did to him. And that moves him. And he hears Reuben, maybe for the first time, he may not have heard this before, but that Reuben had tried to deliver him. Reuben, the oldest son. That might be why Simeon was put in charge, to be in jail. Maybe he would have put Reuben, the oldest, in jail, but it's possible that he heard for the first time that Reuben, unlike the others, had sought to deliver him, and they hadn't listened to him, so maybe he picked the next oldest, Simeon, to punish and put in jail. And he bound him before their eyes. The fact they did it before their eyes is important too. He's trying to make an impact on them. He didn't just drag off Simeon and have him thrown in jail without their seeing it. He wanted them to see this whole thing. He wanted them to see the inside of a jail for 3 days. He wanted them to see their brother get bound and dragged off to prison. This was supposed to make a profound impression on them. I'm sure it did. Verse 25, then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack. Now, he commanded his servants, he didn't let the brothers know that he's doing this, and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack and gave his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, my money has been restored, and there it is in my sack. Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God has done to us? It looked like a bad omen to them. You might think it's a good thing. Hey, I got grain and money too. We came out ahead on this deal. But they realized that this doesn't generally just happen. Either somebody is setting them up, framing them, so they can be accused of something later. And they had reason to think that might be so, because for no reason at all, this Egyptian guy had accused them of being spies. They didn't have anything about them that particularly looked more like spies than other men. Why would they be picked on? And he was treating them roughly for no reason. They had been respectful all along. So, I mean, in their minds, this guy's just chosen to pick on them, and this is probably part of that. The money's back in the sacks, so we can be accused of stealing it. And so they were afraid. Then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man who is the Lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, we are honest men. We're not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father this day in the land of Canaan. Then the man, the Lord of the country, said to us, by this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine to your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me. So I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you may trade in the land. Then it happened as they emptied their sacks that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. How are we going to explain this? And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin away? All these things are against me. Now, when he says, you have bereaved me of my children, he mentions Joseph. It sounds like he might even suspect by this time that they had done something to Joseph. Of course, they've never owned up to it. They're going to have to before this is over. Imagine. I mean, when on that startling occasion when Joseph says, I'm Joseph, your brother. I mean, the stunned response to that, thinking, oh, okay, is he going to hurt us or not? And then to find out, oh, I'm your brother, I forgive you. And they say, oh, good, that's wonderful. Oh, now we've got to go tell Dad Joseph's alive. That means we're going to have to tell Dad that we lied to him, that we sold Joseph into slavery, that we deceived him, that we watched him grieve and we let him grieve without telling him the truth. This is not going to be really the most pleasant thing for them. And they still haven't come clean at this point. They're still deceiving their father, but he may not be all that deceived. He's a bit of a deceiver himself, has at least he's been in the past. And, sometimes a con artist can spot a con artist better than an honest person can. It looks like he might already have it in his suspicion that they have not been straight with him about Joseph's incident. He says, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin away? He says, everything is working against me. And that's what it seems like at times. One thing piles up after another thing. Like Job. One thing happens and before he finishes hearing that story, another report comes of bad news. And just about the time that news is finished being spoken, another guy comes back. It's just one thing after another heaped up. But Jacob had this to learn, and he would learn it soon. And that was that what looked like everything against him was everything being conspiring together for his good, ultimately. He was going to learn. He's not going to lose Benjamin. He's not even going to lose Simeon, and he's going to regain Joseph. And he's not going to suffer from a famine. He's going to get the best of the land of Egypt. Everything's really going to be good. But it all seems bad just before it turns good. Just like with Joseph, before he could rise to the throne, he had to be in prison. It had to get really bad before it could get better. When Moses was sent to the Israelites when they were in slavery in Egypt, and God said, I'm going to deliver them, he starts confronting Pharaoh and so forth, and the Pharaoh makes it worse for the Israelites, not better. It was going to get better, but it got worse first. A lot of times that's just how God deals. You might even be suspicious when things look like they're getting worse than can be easily explained. When the trials are piling up, you always think, oh, I get it. You know, before the arrow can be shot, it has to be pulled backward to create the tension to propel it forward. God's just drawing the bow here. Things are getting worse, but that's because he's about ready to propel things forward into something that's better. Maybe something I can't imagine, something very different than what I wanted. Maybe the things that I wanted are not really good, and God's taking those from me, but it seems to me that everything is against me, that nothing could go right. But God is very ingenious, and we really cannot second guess him. And so many times the scripture points it out that, you know, Jesus is dead and the disciples are hopeless. And then, you know, the best news of their lives comes about. It changes everything about his resurrection and so forth. Those kind of things are commonplace in the Bible and in God's dealings in his people's lives. Then Reuben spoke to his father saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. Now, Jacob didn't buy that. I mean, what incentive could there be for Jacob to accept that offer? Okay, you take Benjamin. If Benjamin doesn't come back, I'll kill my two grandsons. That'll make me feel better. Yeah, that'll be really a good idea. No, that's kind of a stupid suggestion. These guys are kind of desperately thinking, you know, grasping at straws. But Jacob said, my son shall not go down with you. For his brother is dead and he is left alone. That is, of Rachel. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. And so, the story is interrupted by our break. But we will come back to it and see what happens. I know it's going to surprise you.